subscribe to our free podcasts at abc.net.au/rn.
Well, good afternoon to you today. It's Melanie Tate here with Weekend Arts, and I hope you're having a lovely, lovely Saturday afternoon. It's really nice to have your company here today. I wonder whether you've managed to catch much of the programming for Mental As, our way of highlighting Mental Health Week here at the ABC. You might have seen the brilliant Friday night crack-up last night, variety show, which was just gorgeous pretty much from beginning to end. Well, if you have been following Mental As this week, I've got some really exciting news because the ABC has raised over $1 million for mental health in the last week. The tally at the moment is $1,049,821, which is just absolutely incredible. Today on Weekend Arts, we're going to take a look at the link that is forever being made between art and madness. Does it actually exist? Does madness make the artist? Does good art come from madness? We're going to take a look at the Prinzhorn collection, which is 5,000 paintings done by so-called mad people. And Elizabeth Farrelly is known to newspaper readers as an outspoken voice on architecture, public art, and city planning. Now she's turning her pen towards children's adventure with a new novel. Why and what is it like? You'll meet Elizabeth shortly. Plus, Jason DeRosso explores how a kidnapping is treated in an Indian film. While Poetica this week, you'll meet one of the strongest poetic voices of his generation, Omar Musa. But just before we go on to our first story, I want to give you the details if you'd like to donate to Mental As to raise money for mental health awareness here in Australia. What you can do is go to abc.net.au/mentalas. And you can find out how to donate there. You can also call old-fashioned, like, on a telephone, 1300 090 090. That's 1300 090 090. Also, given that you're an art lover being here with me this afternoon, you might like to know that there's an art auction that's part of Mental As, which you can find out about on the website Mental As. But there are some really remarkable paintings that have been donated by some terrific artists who you will have heard here on Weekend Arts and all around the place before. Ben Quilty's one of the artists. Fiona Lowry's one of the artists. Del Catherine Barton. So it's really worth going and checking out because, in actual fact, if I was going to be really crass here for a moment, the art that is being auctioned at the moment is being auctioned for not a whole, well, it's a lot of money, but compared to what these artists are usually going for, it's not as expensive. So anyway, have a look. Have a look on the Mental As website for more details on how you can either donate or be part of that art auction, which has got some really terrific art attached to it. You're on Weekend Arts. When comedian Robert Williams died earlier this year, a lot of the writing about his death assumed his immense talent came in part from the mental illness he'd been very open in speaking about. Indeed, it sparked the question about madness and artistic genius. Is there a link? Do you need to be a little bit mad to be a great artist? Or, conversely, are artists who suffer with mental illness great artists in spite of their mental illness, as comedian Ruby Wax suggested very wisely? Thomas Ruska is the director of the Prinzhorn Collection, which is actually a collection of art created by people in German psychiatric hospitals in the 1920s. Thomas is in Australia at the moment, and I started by asking him who Hans Prinzhorn was and why he had a fascination with the art created by the mentally ill.
Hans Prinzhorn had studied art history first, then he started a career as a singer, and then when his second wife fell ill, he decided to become a doctor and studied medicine. His employment at the university clinic, psychiatric university clinic in Heidelberg, was his first job in 1919, and it was not his idea, but it was the idea of the director to enlarge an already existing collection of artworks from Heidelberg and the nearby Wiesloch, the asylum in Wiesloch. And they did it with the help of an appeal they sent out to all institutions, all asylums, clinics and sanatoria in German-speaking countries, and ask for artworks for a museum for psychopathological art. And it was quite successful. More than 5,000 artworks, mostly on paper, were sent to Heidelberg. So Prince on Collection sounds a bit as if he was a maybe mad collector who was interested in that field and choose what he wanted to have. But it's not the case. It's more a kind of accumulation of what he could get. And the great thing is that he kept it all, so that the collection consists out of a vast different material of artworks, and some of them we only discover in their aesthetic quality now.
Now, it's interesting because we tend to look at this time in psychiatric treatment as being fairly primitive and thinking of people rocking in chairs in rooms all day. Was art actually, though, part of their therapy?
No, there was no art therapy. There was hardly any therapy at all. People who fell mentally ill were mostly just kept in hospitals up to the end of their lives. And the usual development was that they became more and more autistic and finally stopped to communicate at all. Some of them, Prinzhorn saw, started to make art. We would say nowadays, from our perspective, it was a last attempt to communicate and to express what was in them, because they went into that stadium because nobody really cared for them and nobody stimulated them. And for Prinzhorn, it was a sign that these artworks came out of the kind of inner necessity. Nobody helped them to do them. It was just accepted. When you find anything in the medical files, it is an entry like, is occupied with drawing or is occupied with painting. The content and the work themselves were not of importance. Most of them were thrown away anyway. Of importance was that these people were engaged and occupied with something and so didn't disturb the everyday life in the hospital. There was completely different from nowadays, no art therapy, and there were no studios where people could work when they wanted to work. But it's also not the case that everybody who fell mentally ill became an artist. Mm. Prinzhorn states that just 2% of the men and women in hospitals started to draw or to paint, and that's not more than the average in society. It is obviously a situation of specific stress and strain in which these people mobilize their gift of working with artistic material.
Was there any evidence that these people were artists before coming into the hospital?
Most of them not. Women usually had some artistic training as part of their general education, and some of the men in the collection were craftsmen who had made drawings in their jobs, but much more specific technical drawings, for example. Most of them had never had any attachment to art. If there is any characteristic you can detect in these works, it's not a formal or a content characteristic, but it's that you often can sense that somebody starts to make art who has not the capacity and has not the education to do so, and that he does it anyway because he has to do it. You could say he's disobeying all stop signs which normally tell us you are not able to draw and you are not able to paint. And so he mobilizes everything what he has, and that way often is very original because he has to reinvent drawing or perspective or a color scheme, for example. And a lot of things which Prinzhorn collected were beyond even his aesthetic viewpoint. Some of the works we have in this historic collection look already like action painting of the 50s or like surrealist art of the 70s or so.
You're listening to Weekend Arts, and my guest is Dr. Thomas Ruska, and he is the director of the Prinzhorn Collection, which is a group of artworks made by mental patients in Germany in the early 1900s. How does it fare as art itself? If you didn't know, I mean, obviously you spend your entire life with these paintings. If you had come to them without knowing that they were from psychiatric hospitals, how would they fare in your eyes as art? And I guess well, you've got 5,000 paintings. That's probably a hard question to say
nowadays, because of course I am also a child of my time, and the Prinzhorn collection was very influential in art history of the 20th century. I think it's not an exaggeration to say art history would have been different without artworks by mental patients, and especially without Prinzhorn's book. Prinzhorn published in 1922 this book, Artistry of the Mentally Ill, which was lushly illustrated with 185 illustrations, and some of them even in color. That was the first time that for a big audience this area was made visible, you could say, and especially artists reacted very sympathetically to these artworks. We know that the surrealists saw it as a kind of Bible for their own visual arts works, and a lot of them took them as models, took some of the artworks they saw in Prinzhorn's book as models. So I think our taste nowadays is through the official art, or the art of the, you could say, professional artists, already informed about certain features which you can find in these historical artworks of the Prinzhorn collection. And of course, one likes the models sometimes even more than the works which are derived from this model. So, and nowadays we have a very broad view on what's possible in art. And I think a lot of these artworks in the historical Prinzhorn collection do flabbergast you or look stunning, because they seem to be so fresh and original in what they do. Because you can see that somebody is just able to put something which is very important for him or her into a visual entity and to show it. And you can see how pleasant that must have been for the person, and how much he or she was pleased to be able to find an image for pressing contents for them.
After spending so much time with the collection, have you formed any opinions yourself on what this collection says about the mentally ill mind?
I think one of the revolutionary ideas in Prinzhorn's book, which I would subscribe completely, is that there is no feature which you can find in all these works which would enable anybody to say it's a typical artwork by somebody mentally ill. The collection consists of so many different works that it's hard to find anything like that. Of course, there are some moments which could be suspicious, and I think the most important thing maybe is what I already said, that you can feel there is a pressing idea and pressing wish to express, which mobilize everything which is there to be creative. But otherwise, I'm every day again astonished about the richness of ideas and the originality of these works, and some of them are still beyond our aesthetic range of appreciation, and we will probably only discover their whole value in future.
Can I ask you, and it's probably like asking a father to choose his favorite child, do you have a piece of work that speaks to you most loudly?
Oh, there are a lot of works which I really love. One of the works which has not got enough attention, I think, although I tried to put it forward already in a show, is a book which was produced by a patient of the asylum in Regensburg between 1898 and 1908, when he died. His name was Franz Kleber, which you could translate into gluer, and he was really acting, living up to his name, as the medical file also states, because this whole book is glued together out of found material. He has used the free space, the free marginal space of a newspaper, to have a kind of white envelope of the book. It consists out of, I think, 34 pages. Every page has writings on it. And this writing, when you look at it, you can see it's printed writing, which he tore off out of newspapers. And he glued it onto the pages with the help of saliva and bread. He didn't have any proper glue. And he obviously didn't have and was not allowed to have any scissors. So he tore out even single letters, small single letters out of the newspaper and formed his own writing with the help of these letters, page after page after page, year after year after year, with personal messages, very difficult to understand. But very important for him was obviously that he produced a book which looked like a printed book, which looked like a printed book outside of the hospital. And for me, it speaks a lot about wishing to communicate and to be taken seriously with your communication within a situation when you are completely taken away from society and pushed aside of society. This wish to communicate and to be part of society speaks especially out of this moving work.
Dr. Thomas Ruska, thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Thomas Ruska is the director of the Prinzhorn Collection at the University of Heidelberg in Germany, and Thomas is going to be speaking in Melbourne at the Contemporary Outsider Art, the Global Context Conference, which is organised by Arts Project Australia and the University of Melbourne. It's from the 23rd of October. You're on Weekend Arts. My name's Melanie Tate, with you through the afternoon. Elizabeth Farrelly has passionately written about architecture, public art and urban design since the 80s. That's a lot of words about our public spaces and buildings. Now, for the first time, Elizabeth has gone into an imagined world and written a crime adventure for children. It's called Caro Was Here, and it's set in modern Sydney with a bunch of very different school kids being marooned on an island after wagging the afternoon from school. Now, what made Elizabeth do this after all this time, and how difficult or different is it to write a book of children's fiction after years of reviewing and discussing bricks and mortar? I started by asking Elizabeth who this Caro character is.
She's a girl who's too brave, really, and too sort of full of herself for her own good. Someone said, there's a lot of you in her. And I suppose I'd have to admit to that. She is so full of herself that she can't, you know, she can't imagine not wanting to do stuff and put stuff out there and so on. But she, and that, of course, gets her into trouble, and not just her, but some of her friends. The book is really set on one day, which is her 12th birthday, that she's yearned for. And I can remember that feeling, yearning for that. The 12 seems like a marker somehow. She's also not me. She's a, you know, she pretends to be a Leo because she wants to be that kind of bold leader, kind of adventurous type. She's not really a Leo. She's really something else. But that's sort of part of her personality. She needs to be in charge and running the show, and that also gets her into trouble.
Did you ever skive off from school like this and have an adventure?
Well, look, you know, when one of my editors said, you know, this is not really, no middle class kids would actually do this, it's too naughty. And I had to say, I did something very like this when I was, 12. I would be horrified if my children did this, but I did actually skive off school. I was a very, very law-abiding child. And quite shy, but I did persuade some of my friends to climb over a wall on a sort of down day at school after exams. It was hot and the end of term, and we just thought, oh, well, you know, why don't we do something? I thought that, and I persuaded them to come with me, and it was actually even naughtier because we did get caught. We went to the bus stop, got caught by a teacher, was sent back to school, got back there. I think we actually were given detention, and then we thought, No. This afternoon is still boring. and the school had two entrances, two road frontages. And so we went out the other gate to the other road and a different bus. and waited at a different bus stop and got that bus into the city and then got a ferry to an island and got ourselves, I arranged, really, to get ourselves marooned. But we did at least take pity on our parents and call them from a phone box and tell them.
So you got marooned on an island as a child as well, like these characters. Yeah.
So that bit of the story is kind of...
Oh, my gosh. So did you stay overnight?
Yes, we did. And it rained. The rest of the story didn't happen to me.
Thank goodness.
But we did get rained on, and we ended up actually going and taking shelter in a church. And it was, I have to say, it was a really good lesson because it was the most miserable night of my life.
Now, it's interesting that you did something like this. I also did something like this when I was a kid a few years back. I wonder, do you think that any of these adventures would still be able to... You'd still be able to have these adventures in the day of the mobile phone. I mean, you dispense with the mobile phones very well in this book.
You have to. I think, you know, the old rule of children's fiction was get rid of the parents.
Yes.
But actually now I think it's get rid of the phones, which is amounts to the same thing, I suppose. But I wanted to set it in the current time, you know, and to have current mores and things. So I think children culture at the moment is so much fun. But I was very clear that to have an adventure, you had to lose contact, to have a real adventure where there was real danger. And I think danger is what we really deprive our children of these days. We're so, you know, so helicopter about it all. And I include myself in this because I'm guilty of it too. But I think that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, was so that you could have real, scary, dangerous children's adventure and use that as a sort of playground to teach kids how to deal.
You're on Weekend Arts, and my guest is Elizabeth Farrelly, who has just written her first novel, Caro Was Here, and it is an adventure for children, and it's a crime adventure, like you said. Now, I'm really interested in the darkness that you do bring into this book, because I was thinking about it while reading it, about your decision-making, how far to push this darkness, because there's actual adult darkness in this book. Can you tell me a bit about that?
To be honest, in the first draft, it was a little bit darker, a little bit scarier. There was a little bit more, what my editor called gratuitous violence, a bit more sort of whacking and stuff. I mean, it's partly to do with what I loved as a child, what I loved to read. I've, you know, read myths and legends wildly and adventure stories and, you know, African stories when Africa seemed like this sort of mysterious continent still, full of voodoo and scary stuff. I think that it's a very good moral playground. You know, it's like the elephant's graveyard in Lion King, the need to go somewhere scary in order to understand how that works and how to deal with it is an important part of learning, I think. For me, the most interesting and the most beautiful, I was going to say this is an aesthetic thing in a way, a beautiful way of dealing with the sort of light and dark of moral character. And so I wanted to, and I always loved 19th century children's fiction because of the way it does that, like even things like The Water Babies. If you read the original story of The Water Babies, it's full of nastiness and violence as a counterpoint to goodness, you know, which is what the world is like. So I sort of think it's important to show children that because it's exciting, but it's also educational.
And so in terms of knowing how far to push that, did you go back to your own 11-year-old self or did you check in with your children?
Neither of those, I think. I slightly overwrote it. And I have the bad guys in this story have been accused by one or two people of being a bit cartoonish. And I think they are. And I think part of that, I wanted to make them a little bit funny because that makes them less scary. It was, I suppose, a slightly delicate thing. There's a gently sort of satirical edge to it for that reason. So, you know, if it gets scary, you can kind of see it slightly as a comic book thing. But I wanted to make it just scary enough so that it felt that there was something real at stake. Plot's really important to me. I am a story addict. That notion of the sort of the primitive power of a good story to carry kind of moral importance or moral play, the sort of moral dance of life seemed to be really important. And that's why I found it fun to write children's literature because it could do that.
What was the moral that you tried to get across in this book?
One of them is about being too brave, that you can actually be too brave. There is a limit to the degree to which bravery is a good thing. So you can overdo it. You can also be, I mean, Caro, of course, is the main character. She demonstrates this. You can be too out there and too confident and too full of yourself and too driven to compete, I guess, is what she does with the other characters, to her detriment. What's interesting to me about her as a character is that she has to draw on exactly those characteristics to rescue not just herself but the others. Everybody's good and bad, depending on the situation and depending on how they use themselves and how they entangle with what's happening. So that's what really interested me about it. I'm not sure if that amounts to a moral.
There's also a great tenderness to this book, though, as well. And I'm so angry with myself for not highlighting it. There's a beautiful line about the character Tatty, how kind she was and how lovely that was when you were sad.
Yes.
But how it was no help on an adventure.
Yes.
But that there is a sense of tenderness between these characters the whole way through as well, which is so, so lovely. I'd love to know as well how you came to write this book, because we know you very well from, you know, your public commentary. How did you come to write a children's book?
I mean, I suppose everybody's writing a novel, really. And I was writing mine, which, of course, is crime. And I'm still writing it, to be honest, although it is now progressing. But I was at the time stuck on this novel, you know, because I get almost no time to write fiction because I'm so busy earning a living, which is infuriating. But so I do it in the sort of half hour each morning before the kids get up. And that makes it really slow. But I was writing this novel and getting sort of stuck on the middle bit of the plot, and it was annoying me because I couldn't find the voice. So I thought something came across into my email, I guess. It was Judith Ridge's course advertising what was then the Sydney Writers' Centre, was now the Australian Writers' Centre, isn't that right? It switched. So one of the courses, then they do a number of courses, all of which look interesting, and I'd been doing another course with my novel, which was also really interesting, at the Writers' Studio in Bondi, but that's a whole different story. But this little one was just short and sharp and online, and I thought, I can do that over a few weeks. I can't remember how long it was, because I'd been cooking up this idea, and I thought, I'll just use that one about that girl, Caro, and that island adventure, and see if I can make it into something and do it quickly, and then that'll give me a sense of satisfaction. It'll be fun. And, of course, it wasn't anything like as quick or easy as I thought, but the course was really interesting, and Judith's sort of framework for novel writing was really simple and sort of a three-part thing, which appealed to me because of Aristotle, I guess. So I thought, oh, I can hold that in my head. I can just do this small thing and write it. And so I just wrote it. It gave me a momentum, and I did it over about 3 or 4 months. And then, of course, there was a lot of reworking. I actually sent it to an agent, and she said, go away.
So now that's interesting to me, though, because you would think that being published in Sydney Morning Herald, The Age, Canberra Times, etc., would make it quite easy to get an agent and a publishing deal.
You would think that, but not the case, partly because, you know, first fiction is always difficult, whoever you are. And on the one hand, publishers will say, oh, yeah, profile's useful. But on the other hand, it's such a different market that it may not be all that useful, certainly in those initial stages. And then someone else said to me, don't worry with an agent, just go straight to the publisher. And I actually had a friend who had been a children's book agent and publisher in London. And she sweetly read it for me and said, no, you should do something with this. Send it to Walker Books. They're the best in Australia. And I did that and heard nothing at all for ages, except possibly thank you for the book. And then like months and months, like almost a year later, they said, oh, is this book still available? And I thought, oh, yes. And of course, they still hadn't read it. But then they said, okay, so if it's still available, we will read it. So it was an incredibly long, drawn-out process. I don't know, maybe half a dozen of them read it together and decided to take it on. But so it was more than a year, it's probably 18 months between finishing that first draft and having it accepted. So I suppose the moral of that story is don't give up.
Can you tell me about using Sydney so specifically in this book?
Oh,
because
yeah.
I know that a lot of publishers encourage you to write cities that you can't really identify so that it can be sold overseas, etc. Did you have any pressure like that?
No. That's what I love about books. I read a lot of Carl Hiaasen and James Lee Burke, and Carl Hiaasen is always set in Florida, and James Lee Burke is always set around a place called New Iberia near New Orleans, and they are so place-specific. You have particular streets and particular species and all sorts of you can smell the landscape, and that's what I love. I really respond, and I suppose maybe this is my sort of architecture self coming out, but I respond very intensely to place in literature. And so I think it's a real mistake to make places anonymous. I also think that Sydney is breathtakingly beautiful and underrepresented in our literature. We don't really talk about it, and yet it's just this amazing place with this incredible crime background and this wonderful light that does such intense light and shadow that seems to me that naturally represents its kind of crime landscape. So I think it's a gift.
Elizabeth Farrelly, architecture commentator and now author of children's crime adventure novel, Kara Was Here. You're on Weekend Arts, Melanie Tate with you for the rest of the afternoon.
Next on All in the Mind, a new take on happiness.
Less of being that over-caffeinated, extremely jolly, big smiley kind of face, and much more about having a meaningful, fulfilled life connected to who you are.
And coaching can provide useful skills for well-being.
With organisations who think about coaching with leaders, that's really where the magic is. Listening, being mindful, really having unconditional positive regard for the other person.
All in the Mind with me, Lynn Malcolm, this Sunday at 5.
Last week we brought to you the story of Frank Waters and the Waters Gallery, this year celebrating its 50th anniversary as we've seen other commercial galleries closing around Australia. So this week we thought we'd take a look at some of the different ways galleries are springing up, and I'd love to hear from you on this if you have time. Do let me know what sorts of galleries you've seen around your town. For example, my dentist's surgery also operates as a gallery. Madeline Preston and Anthony Baltovit have opened their home as a gallery. I knocked on their door recently and asked them why they're letting strangers wander around looking at art.
It's something we've been, Madeline and I have been talking about for a couple of years. We thought the space would work. We enjoy showing new and emerging artists, and I like people coming through the house.
Now, what's your background before opening the gallery here?
Well, I'm an osteopath and chiropractor, so pretty far away from having a life in art. But I guess my interest in art started when I met Madeline, which was about 7 years ago. Helping her set up her shows and going to openings triggered my interest in art, and it's basically developed from there.
How does it work practically, opening up your house as a gallery? Has it been a difficult thing, for example, with council, etc.?
Look, it has been a bit of a struggle with council, but initially our DA was rejected, but I made an appeal, and they gave us a 12-month trial, and we've just got our permanent status now, so we're here to stay.
And how do your neighbours feel about what's going on? Have you had any feedback from them? We can hear somebody next door doing some renovations.
Yeah, that's George, my neighbour. He's still renovating his house. But look, the local community here are very supportive. We're actually hoping to do a ceramics night in the new year with a few of the local businesses here. We've got Sensations Tea House across the street that show a bit of ceramics as well. So, yeah, we're interested in getting involved with the local community, and the neighbours have been great.
And do you consider yourself a commercial gallery?
That's a good question. I guess yes, because we do want to sell work. We try to sell work for artists. So I guess the answer is yes.
We kind of feel that we've made a new model, or a different model, if you like. So it's a model that involves selling work, but we're also interested in showing installational work that doesn't necessarily have a sort of saleable value, if you like, or you can't put a value to it, but it's still worth exhibiting. So we've got a mixed model where artists pay a fee to show with us. It's a relatively small fee for a period of about 3.5 weeks. And then on top of that, there's a 20% commission, which most galleries, commercial galleries, is a 40%, with some in Sydney actually doing a 60% commission. So there's, you know, we're of quite a kind of mixed model, if you like. We're not quite an artist-run initiative, but we're not also a full commercial gallery, and we're not looking to move into representation or you know, looking to represent artists, if you like. We're more about getting as many artists to have an opportunity to exhibit.
So what was the artistic vision when you first set the gallery up, Madeline?
I guess for me it was the idea that there are an enormous amount of artists out there that don't get the opportunity to show. Partly that's to do with Sydney real estate. Sydney has, galleries have kind of contracted over the years, partly due to the GFC, partly due to a whole range of reasons, but a lot is to do with the increasing development of the inner city. So galleries have spread out a bit, but also people can't afford the space. So having seen the model elsewhere, and it has actually existed in Sydney before, where you have a house opened up, we felt that if we could entice people into a house and say to them, you can actually look at contemporary art in a context that you understand, in a place that you'll feel comfortable, that more people might be able to exhibit, but also more people might actually engage with contemporary art. So there was a kind of a mixed drive, if you like.
How have you found the artists who are exhibiting here?
That actually takes a lot of time. Anthony does quite a bit of that, so he'll spend, because he works from home, he can spend a fair bit of time looking at work online. So I'd encourage all artists to make sure they have a web presence. That's my first thing I would say to any artist. We also go to lots of shows, grad shows, when studios are open. So NAS might have an open day and the studios are open there. Try and meet as many artists, and through meeting artists in that environment, then we get to meet other ones. They'll suggest their friends, or people will make submissions to the website. In the last year, we've exponentially grown the amount of artists we know, and I also have a fair few contacts from being an artist myself.
You've touched on this before, Madeline, that a lot of Sydney galleries have had to shut because of escalating rents. You don't have that trouble here. Is this the way forward then to having an affordable gallery?
It's definitely an option. I don't think it's for everyone. It would be it's pretty time consuming, and you know, the model I don't think would work for everyone, but for us it is working. And look, overheads are a big concern for galleries, there's no doubt about it. So if it's something that you can offset, it's a good idea.
A couple of people since we've opened have mentioned that, we got a mention where they said that Leo Castelli, the famous New York gallerist, had started the same way, which I was unaware of. And someone who represents probably one of my favourite German artists, Nia Rausch, is actually his dealer, who's now very big off the back of Nia Rausch, started off sleeping in his bathroom and using his apartment to show work. So I think the model's happened elsewhere. I think other people can do it. It is, as Anthony said, though, not for everyone. And because of Anthony being an osteopath, it was set up in a sense, so it was kind of a very easy transition. But some people might find it harder. I'd love to see more of them. I think it'd be great going into apartments, and I think that's part of the appeal for people. They come in here and they think, oh, I'll just have a look at the house as well. So, yeah.
Do you feel ambition beyond the house as well for this gallery?
Not at this stage. I mean, it's difficult to say what could happen in the future, but we just want to keep curating good shows and showing good work and having good relationships with artists. And I think we'll just keep that formula going for a period of time. And what could happen down the track, we're not sure.
That's Anthony Baltovich and Madeline Preston there at their home at 7, their gallery, I was going to say their gallery, which is also their home. It's called Home at 735, which you can find on Bourke Street, Redfern, 735 Bourke Street, Redfern in Sydney, open Thursdays to Sunday. Now it's time to catch up with Jason DeRosso and find out what's going on at the movies with The Final Cut.
Hi, and welcome to The Final Cut. Jason DeRosso with you. This week, Gone Boy, a new Canadian film set in India called Siddharth, is about a poor family whose 12-year-old son goes missing. It is every bit as interesting philosophically as the much bigger Hollywood film last week, which was also about a disappearance. And you'll meet the film's Indian-Canadian writer-director, Richie Mehta, in just a moment. But first, the big film of the week is The Judge, starring Robert Duvall and Robert Downey Jr.
We need to establish a firm defense. We got to get the charges dropped and make it all go away at the preliminary hearing. We never go to trial.
There's no we here, Henry. This was an accident, period. Any decent lawyer can argue this easily. And by decent, I mean honest. Someone from here, someone with integrity that an Indiana judge will respect.
A homecoming story and a legal scandal are jumping-off points for The Judge, a sentimental but often compelling family drama with some blood-is-thicker-than-water truisms and optimistic reflections on the state of the American body politic. Robert Duvall plays a recently widowed country judge on the cusp of retirement that's charged with deliberately running over and killing a local crook. Robert Downey Jr. is his son, a cynical big city lawyer who must suppress considerable resentment towards the old man to organise his defence. Directed by journeyman filmmaker David Dobkin, who made Wedding Crashers of all things, it's co-written by Nick Schenck, the man responsible for Clint Eastwood's pensioner vigilante fantasy Gran Torino. The Judge, in many ways, contains similar themes about a more idealistic American yesteryear informing the country's jaded present. Duvall's Judge might be a self-righteous and delusional old Reaganite, but there's a decency to him that is out of sync with his careerist son, who's made a fortune defending criminals. As a lawyer, Robert Downey Jr.'s character is an A-grade a-hole. An opening scene in a bathroom has him urinating on arrival. But as a father of one going through a messy divorce, he's a sympathetic anti-hero with issues. A bit like Iron Man's Tony Stark, Robert Downey Jr. plays him somewhere between a jaded court jester and an exasperated genius. And there's an assortment of hometown characters who continually get under his skin. An old flame who now runs the local diner, played by Vera Farmiga, the brothers who never left town, Vincent D'Onofrio and Jeremy Strong, and a bumbling but disarmingly sincere assistant, played by Dax Shepard. Focusing on the contrast between tidy appearances and messy realities, The Judge is a film where difficult truths eventually come to light. Longtime Spielberg cinematographer Janusz Kaminski, who shot Lincoln and Schindler's List, amongst others, builds a fitting contrast between the bucolic prettiness of the town exteriors and a chiaroscuro moodiness inside the family home and the courtroom. Sure enough, there are surprises in the shadows, so many that by the end of the film you feel like you've witnessed just about every family drama cliche in the book, which, depending on how much you like this sort of thing, may or may not be a problem. After all, you could be forgiven for going to see The Judge on the strength of the cast alone. It is the kind of ensemble family drama that often pops up after the Northern Hemisphere summer in the lead up to Christmas and Thanksgiving. Last year, for example, we had Meryl Streep, Julia Roberts and others trading insults over the dinner table in August, Osage County. And studios are probably right to believe there's a particular voyeuristic appetite for seeing family dysfunction performed by A-list stars as the holiday season draws near. To give The Judge its due, too, there are some moments that feel raw and truthful, like a scene between Duvall and Downey Jr. in a bathroom, scrambling over a medical emergency that seems to pop out of nowhere with its confronting portrayal of corporeal decrepitude. And oh, we get a shot of Duvall's feet sloshing around a dirty bath. How often do you get to see a Hollywood star's decrepit feet in a movie? I can only think the last time was Kate Winslet's in Revolutionary Road, but I digress. Unfortunately, the film's more derivative middle register and the overabundance of storylines constitutes a problem that's hard to ignore. The biggest casualty of all this clutter is the court case itself, where Billy Bob Thornton, fresh from delivering perhaps the performance of his career in True Detective, plays a prosecuting attorney with a personal vendetta against the defence team. It's a pity to see his ominous character, who looks a bit like a lizard squeezed into a suit, relegated to a second-string role, and it's a disappointment that the courtroom lacks a truly memorable scene. For a story that's meant to illustrate a profound confidence, despite everything, in American justice as a kind of direct representation of an essential decency, this oversight is not a hanging offence, but it comes close. The Judge is rated M.
My father's a lot of unpleasant things, and murder is not one of them.
But he is a liar. We've established that. A liar who thinks he can operate under the color of the law just like his son. You're a shined up wooden nickel, Mr. Palmer. A bully with a big bag of tricks. But unlike you, I have one simple belief. That the law is the only thing capable of making people equal.
On RN, you're listening to The Final Cut, talking film with me, Jason DeRosso.
Papa, pinggi ko bolna, jab main wapas aaunga, hum saath mein cricket khelenge. Bolna mat.
Haan haan, bol dunga beta, chinta na kar.
Bye.
Bye, Papa.
Pahunch ke phone karna.
Following on from Gone Girl last week comes a small Canadian film shot in India about a missing boy and the poor Delhi family who try looking for him. Shot with a minimum budget, its Spartan camera work recalls neorealism, and in fact you could say that thematically as the central mystery of the boy's disappearance unfolds at bustling street level. The film plays a little bit like the neorealist classic, The Bicycle Thieves. Indian-Canadian director Richie Mehta handles the suspense well and populates the story with a series of colourful characters and striking landscapes, both urban and rural. But perhaps what's most remarkable is the way that the film's emotional register differs from the Western melodramatic tradition. These very poor characters sit in a very different place. Like notes in a minor key, they are restrained and stoic for reasons that seem to be as much cultural as they are economic. Whatever the case, the result is a film about what it's like to face a crisis with next to no agency in a society that ignores you. No one to rely on, no support structures, no money or holidays stored up for an emergency. This desperate mother and father, in some ways, are more like ghosts than citizens. It's a deeply unsettling vision. Here's Canadian writer-director Richie Mehta. This is his second film, and both have been shot in India.
Because I was born in Toronto, in Canada, my parents are from India, I spoke the language growing up, so I had that kind of connection. But my first experience actually going to India when I was 16 was really disturbing and really kind of, in a way it's kind of classical stereotypical, boy ventures out from developed world into, the city around him and sees what people are living in. And I actually never realized that growing up in the middle class in Canada, I was elite. And that really, really struck me and bothered me. So I said to myself I would never go back to India unless I had a reason to address this. And then these films became those reasons. The first film, Amal, was based on a short story my brother wrote, which addressed these issues, and so I wanted to address that in my work. And then Siddharth was landed on my lap. I mean, it was just somebody who spoke to me on the streets when I was in a rickshaw, and it was a driver, and he asked me for help to find his missing boy, and the nature of that conversation was so disturbing, and yet there was an optimism to it. There was all kinds of things, conflicting things. So I just keep addressing these issues, and every time I say, okay, that's it, I'm not working here for the next few films, just when I'm leaving, something will happen, which will just entice me and stick in my mind, and I have to go back.
Your film and your story reminds me a little bit of the career thus far of an Egyptian-Canadian female director whose name escapes me at the moment, but I think, well, the last film
Ruben Nutter.
Yeah, Ruben Nutter. Her last film was Cairo Story, which I adored. I'm wondering if you think that there is something unique, or there's something you have to offer as someone kind of straddling both worlds, going back to India and putting a lens on that reality there. I mean, as an outsider, but of Indian heritage, you know, what do you bring, do you think, to the vision?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a great observation. And, you know, I Ruba and I are friends, and there's even a bunch of other filmmakers kind of going back to their own respective countries of origin, trying to tell these types of stories. I definitely think there's a bit of a cultural ambassadorial role that emerges, because we're able to kind of speak both languages and see both cultures from the outside. I'm starting to spend so much time in India that I'm feeling like an outsider in Canada, so my observations are becoming outsider, which is not a bad thing, I think. And I think in this case, something that's very important to me is to present stories in that environment which don't necessarily have a character that links to the outside world at the onset. You know, we don't necessarily have a Canadian who's in that environment that we can say, okay, that's me in that environment. I just want to dive into, in every way, a different world, and then over the course of the film, start to find ways for people outside of India to relate. In this case, in a film like Siddharth, we're talking about people on the streets, and what they say and what they do is so foreign to us. But then there's, you know, when a cell phone shows up, the nature of how it's showing up in that film, I think, is a link to, oh my God, I can see now my point of entry into this world. That's very important to me. That is not just aesthetic, it's built into the theme.
Let's talk about the great sort of emotional story that this is. I mean, we have a family desperately trying to track down a missing 12-year-old son. But what struck me was that there is a slightly, I mean, the emotions are slightly underplayed. I think if this was set in a middle-class, suburban, Western environment, I think perhaps there'd be a bit more hysteria. The conclusion I came to
was that these people are working so hard and there is just almost no time to react with hysterics. And that, to me, was quite interesting. Do you understand what I'm saying by that reaction?
I totally do. And in fact, it was something that we discussed a lot, me and the actors, tonally. It was something very important to me to try and get right. Because we're talking about, you're partly right about what you're saying. There's one more layer to that. In the labor class, in that environment, and this is a general comment, but it applies to so many people I've seen. They're so used to being around people who are above them, class-wise, that they're used to not expressing themselves because they just kind of keep their heads down and keep going. It's to their benefit to be invisible. You don't want to attract attention in those environments because you can easily be victimized. And, you know, if anyone decides to target you, you have no say in justice. So you just keep your head down. You don't express yourself. You keep quiet. As a result, you have all kinds of emotional suppression happening in that environment. You know, the idea of depression, it's rampant as a reality, but it's not diagnosed because nobody's talking about it. Everyone can just be sad and that's it. But of course, there are exceptions to the rules. You have feisty people who completely express themselves, and the children have not become suppressed yet, so they are expressing themselves. But this is very important to me to get right.
Well, I found it fascinating, and I was also wondering if there was also a touch of Indian spiritualism or a sense of a non-Christian way or outlook and way of looking at destiny and way of looking at and bearing with tragedy.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it definitely underpins the whole thing. If I were to, and I curbed that a little bit on purpose, if I were to really, really play the odds on this statistically, at some point in the middle of the film, the father would have said, oh, it's God's will, and maybe given up, statistically. So what I'm showing is even kind of more commitment to that, which is what I found in the person I met. So you do have a lot of fatalism. You do have a lot of people say, oh, this is God's will, and this is, you know, my karma. And as a result, this is what I have to endure. And in the film, we do show a lot of people, you know, I don't show the father. In fact, I made the father pretty much a non-believer. But the people around him certainly do. You know, there's an incredible belief in faith in these environments. And there's something, you know, if it gets them emotionally through it, then maybe they have the tools to cope with something that I don't. I can't judge that, though.
Writer-director Richie Mehta, his wonderful film Siddharth is out now on limited release. And a correction, that film of Ruben Nadar's we mentioned is actually called Cairo Time, not Cairo Story, also worth tracking down. I'm Jason DeRosso. I'll see you on The Final Cut next week.
Thanks so much, Jason. And Jason just wanted me to let you know that he referred to Billy Bob Thornton as starring in True Detective when, of course, he meant Fargo. You're on Weekend Arts. I'm Melanie Tate with you through the afternoon. Stay tuned for just one moment because I'm about to let you know what exciting things are coming up during the rest of the show.
Next on All in the Mind, a new take on happiness.
Less of being that over-caffeinated, extremely jolly, big, smiley kind of face, and much more about having a meaningful, fulfilled life connected to who you are.
And coaching can provide useful skills for well-being.
With organisations who think about coaching with leaders, that's really where the magic is. Listening, being mindful, really having unconditional positive regard for the other person.
All in the Mind with me, Lynn Malcolm, this Sunday at 5.
After the news, as we are heading very quickly towards them, Christos Tsolkas says his voice roars. Irvin Welsh said after reading his new novel, every other novel of the year will seem criminally dull. This week on Poetica, poet and novelist Omar Musa, is he a voice for his generation? You'll find out after the news. Plus, I just wanted to give you another reminder to, if you can, donate to Mental As, the ABC's support of Mental Health Week. So far, the tally is $1,061,091. It would be great if you had a few spare dollars to be able to put towards that. There's also an art auction with art from artists including Ben Quilty, Del Catherine Barton, Fiona Lowry, and it's really, really wonderful. So do go and have a look at the website, which is abc.net.au/mentalas, or you can, of course, call on an old-fashioned telephone, 1300 090 090, if you would like to donate to Mental As. I'm hoping that in the next hour we're going to be able to play Eddie Perfect's terrific song from last night's Friday Night Crack-Up, which was part of Mental As. It was absolutely terrific. And if you haven't seen it, I'd encourage you to get to iView to check it out while it's still there. It's there at the moment, so if you've got a spare few hours, get over there and watch it today. But if you can, do donate. abc.net.au/mentalas. It's coming up to news time. I'm Melanie Tate. I'll be back with you after the news for more Weekend Arts.